Welcome in Outkick the Coverage Wins and Losses podcast. I'm Clay Travis. We've now done 37 of these long form conversations. I appreciate all of you who've been listening to them. A lot of great ones to go listen to. This one going out as we get close to Christmas 2020, the end of what has been an unbelievably challenging and difficult year for many of you out there. Certainly, the sports world has not been immune from those challenges. And we bring in now the commissioner of the Big Ten Conference, Kevin Warren, who has dealt with a lot of those challenges himself. You haven't been a commissioner very long, and I'm sure there was no handbook to handle what was going on in 2020. Appreciate you joining us, Commissioner Warren. Merry Christmas, happy holidays in advance here. Appreciate you joining us on Christmas Eve. I'm sure you're ready to turn the page into 2021 like a lot of people out there.
Oh, yeah. But, you know, Clay, first of all, I just thank you for having me on to your show. And, you know, 2020 had some challenges, I think, for all of us. But I think as you turn around and look back, I mean, we've been blessed to be able to work through some of the issues that we have. And I'm looking forward to a really positive and productive 2021. You know, anytime we face the challenges like we did, but then when you're able to come through them and stay together, I know we in the Big Ten are stronger than we were probably a year ago at this time because we've had to face some adversity. And so I'm glad to be with you here today. Look forward to a great conversation. Looking forward to finishing up 2020 strong, but also looking forward to a great 2021.
All right, we've got a lot that I want to get into, but for people who listen to Wins and Losses, we try to get to the background of the person that we're talking about and talking with. And mm-hmm. and I haven't read a ton about, you know, you as a young guy and how you ended up being Big Ten commissioner. And I think there's probably a lot of people out there who have those questions. So we're going to start off right at the beginning, if you're cool with that, and roll through in this way. Where did you grow up? What was your childhood like? How would you describe it?
Yeah, so I graduated I'll go back even further than that. I was born in Phoenix, Arizona. Both of my parents were educators. My father, Morrison Warren, was a football student athlete at Arizona State University in the mid-40s. He went and fought in the war for a couple years and then took a leave from college, came back and finished up his college career and was voted a couple years ago as one of the 50, you know, greatest football players in Arizona State football history. But he was an educator. He came back, graduated from college, got his master's from Arizona State, and got his doctorate from Arizona State, and then was an elementary school principal for many, many years, you know, in Phoenix before later in his life he finally got an opportunity to be a professor at Arizona State. So I've grown up around university campuses. My mother, who was really the kind of the backbone of our family, also was an educator. She didn't get her college degree until she had me at 40 years old and went back to college after that and graduated and earned her a master's. She loved to read. She was a librarian. So grew up in the house of two educators and youngest of seven kids. My oldest brother played football at Stanford in the 60s. And so although athletics was incredibly important my family, but as you can imagine, academics was number one, and we didn't get a chance to play sports until we proved that we did our best in the classroom. So grew up in an enclave in Phoenix called South Phoenix, and then probably in around fourth or fifth grade, moved to Tempe, Arizona. As I said, my dad was a professor then at Arizona State, so grew up in South Tempe, a nice, you know, simple neighborhood, and was a student athlete myself at Marcos Denisa High School in Tempe, Arizona, was a recruited basketball student athlete, more of a mid-major type player, and chose to go to the University of Pennsylvania and played there and as a true freshman. And Bob Weinhauer recruited me there, who I still stay in touch with today. And then after my freshman year, he came and took a job at Arizona State, and which was only 5 miles from my house. So actually transferred back to Arizona State for a short period of time, and then I finished up at Grand Canyon University in Phoenix, Arizona, and I was very fortunate to have a very strong college basketball career and eventually went into their College Basketball Hall of Fame. But after I graduated from Grand Canyon University, I did go to Arizona State to get my MBA, and then I had a sister who became sick, who was living in South Bend at the time, and that's how I ended up at Notre Dame Law School. So that was my educational background, and then got a call one day from a friend who connected me with a man by the name of Mike Slive, who I interviewed with, who became like a father figure to me, and he hired me right out of law school. So I got a chance to work with Mike Slive to do NCAA investigations, that we defended colleges and universities. Mike went on to be the iconic commissioner of the SEC, and he told me eventually I would be in college athletics one day, and he was right. But I went from working with Slive to starting my own sports and entertainment representation firm, and then after that, got a job with the St. Louis Rams, again from another father figure, Dick Vermeil, and spent 4 years at the Rams, won a Super Bowl with the greatest show on turf, had a stop with the Lions as an executive position, and then went back into private practice and worked on the deal to help the Will family acquire the Vikings. And then we moved to Minnesota in 2005, thinking we'd be there maybe for a year or so, and ended up being in Minnesota for 15 years, and then which subsequently led to me being contacted to have an opportunity to meet with the Big Ten. And then I was hired in 2019 as a commissioner of the Big Ten and been here ever since.
All right, I want to unpack a little bit of that. That's a great run through. We're talking to Big Ten Commissioner Kevin Warren. You said your dad fought in World War II. What did he do, and what did he tell you about that experience?
You know, one of the things my dad taught me, and I really appreciate my parents, you know, they raised all of us, but especially me, and I was youngest of seven kids, is to never make excuses, to stand tall, keep your shoulders back, keep your chin tight, to stand tall and work through, you know, issues, and to always remember to count your blessings, that they would always say that there are so many people in the world who would love to be in the position that you're in right now, regardless of that. They've said that from the day that I can remember, you know, have the fondest memories. But he fought in World War II. He was stationed in Germany, and he spent more time talking to me about the Holocaust than he did slavery. And I think he felt that you know, I would learn about slavery by being a black man, you know, in America, and you know, just understanding, hearing people talk about it. But he said, I want you to understand just the certain atrocities that have occurred. And he talked to me about Auschwitz and Buchenwald and the horrors of the Holocaust, and said, whatever you do, Kevin, make sure that you never let either slavery or the Holocaust ever happen again. So those are many of the lessons. He had pictures, you know, that he showed me from that were taken in the concentration camps. And I just remember seeing the you know, many bodies stacked there. And so, you know, I just appreciate both of my parents always being transparent, candid, and sharing with me, you know, things about life and challenging us to try to make sure that we have the world and make the world a better place.
What was his experience like in the service? Obviously, there was a segregated army at that time. What was his role? Obviously, I can't imagine. I mean, for any of those kids, I'm fascinated by World War II history in general, because so many people, one of my favorite stories to tell is, I was reading about the 101st Airborne and the toughness of those guys and what they did. But one of the stats, one of the data points that stuck out to me is the vast majority of people who were in that airborne battalion, the 101st, the first time they ever went up in an airplane, Kevin, they jumped out of it. And to think about the bravery of that, I mean, anybody who's ever been in an airplane, most of those guys had never been in an airplane before. But think about how nervous you are the first time you step on an airplane at whatever age you are. To be willing to jump out of an airplane the first time you ever go up into it. I mean, those guys were a different breed. And I mean, and most of them, you know, again, because of the parochial nature of America at the time, the idea of going to Europe, the vast majority of people would have never gone to Europe, much less go to Europe, fight Nazis, and end up in a world war. It's really remarkable to think about all these 19, 20, 21-year-old kids and what they did.
And it was, Clay, you're right, exactly on point. I mean, it's one of the things that I just as I got older, I started to recognize, you know, just data points in people's age. I mean, you think about it, my dad spent, you know, first 2 years in college. And so, you know, when he went to the war, he said, you know, you're probably 20 years old. And to think to go and serve for our country and to be proud to serve, you know, for our country, a lot of the things that they did then, we're still benefiting, you know, from now. And so when you put it in perspective, you know, at that age. And then I even look at my brother, who's a hero of mine, you know, Morrison Warren, who played at, you know, Stanford, was a phenomenal student athlete and ended up hurting his knee, but he never transferred. He stayed there, graduated, but he volunteered to go to, he wasn't even drafted, but he volunteered to go fight in Vietnam. And so whether people agree with, you know, whether Vietnam should or shouldn't happen or all those, you know, from a political standpoint, but it's just more the moxie of the people that fought in World War II and the people that fought in all of our wars to be able to go to protect this, you know, country. I as I've gotten older and learned things about, you know, my dad, things that he did, and most of the things that he did were not told to me. A lot of them were told to me by him, but were told by others. And whether it was even at his funeral, that people who would say things that I didn't even know about. And but I was just proud to be his son and to see what he's done for the United States of America.
How much age range was there between you and your oldest brother that you were just talking about? Because I think you said you're the youngest of seven.
Yeah, 20.
20 years.
Yeah, 20 years. So he was actually a junior in college when I was born. So my father, my mom and dad, my parents were more like my grandparents. My grandparents were more like my great-grandparents. My brother Morrison was more like my dad. So that's why I have a brother. I mean, my father's name is Morrison. My brother's name is Morrison. Then I have a nephew who's also named Morrison. We went to Notre Dame Law School together, went to high school together. He's a lawyer in Chicago now for Chapman and Cutler, phenomenal lawyer, but he's more like a brother to me because we're only 2 years apart. But it's a 20-year differential.
So how do you think your childhood compared to your older brothers and sisters? If you're the youngest, do you think, because I kind of think about the family dynamic aspect. I've got three sons myself. They're 12, they're 12, 10, and 6. And there's obviously, even though there's only 6 years that separate my you know, oldest and my youngest, there's a big difference there between the oldest and the youngest. I can't imagine 20 years.
Yeah, it is. You know, my siblings, older siblings, used to tease me about it when I was younger, how much more harder and demanding my parents were on them, you know, than me. But then they also told me, you know, I had different pressures, you know, on me that they didn't, you know, have, because we had, you know, there was a period there where my mom probably had three kids and, you know, in diapers. So although there was a 20-year gap, you know, I'm grateful for it because it gave me much more time with my parents. And my sister Marilyn, who actually was married to John Shumate, who was a great basketball player at Notre Dame and played in the NBA for many years. She got married, I think, at like 19 or 20. So I was a young teenager. So for the majority of my life, I was almost like an only child. That's why I got close to my nephew Morrison. But I had an older sister, Carolyn, who's the one who died of brain cancer, that my wife and I started Carolyn's Comfort, you know, the scholarship and foundation in honor of her. But she actually went through a divorce, and so she moved back in my parents' house, and so she was there, so it was good to have my older sister back in the house. But I just think, you know, my parents were always fair with us. They did a good job of knowing you know, kind of the different things that, because all kids, you got three, I have two, they're different, you know, they're same, similar in a lot of areas, but they're different. But they always did a good job of really understanding what we needed from a, you know, physical, emotional, you know, spiritual and mental standpoint. And so I'm grateful to have grown up in their house.
How did your family end up in Arizona?
You know, interesting enough, my mother was born in Douglas, Arizona, a mining town in Arizona. And her father was a soldier who was stationed in Fort Huachuca, Arizona. And her mom was a she's from Guadalajara, Jalisco, Mexico, and she was a maid. And so they ended up, I think my grandmother met my grandfather at the Army base, and she was, like I said, from Mexico, and they ended up getting married. And my mom was born in Douglas and ended up migrating up to Phoenix. And my dad was, he's from Texas, and so from Marlin, Texas, which ironically I believe is the hometown of LaDainian Tomlinson. And but my parents were there. My grandfather was a black male man from Marlin, Texas. My grandmother was predominantly, you know, African American and Choctaw Indian, and they met and had my dad, and I think he had about six or seven other siblings. And my dad moved to Phoenix and when he was about 18 months old, and so my grandfather, although really not educated at all, but he was an entrepreneur and ended up, I think, owning probably the first black drugstore in Phoenix, and then he was a porter at the Lures Hotel in Phoenix, Arizona, for many years. So ended up working, the story is that he worked, I think, 17 years, 7 days a week, and never missed a day of work, battled with emphysema. He was a no-nonsense guy, Fred Hubbard Warren. And so every time I'm in Phoenix, I really make it a point to drive by the Lures Hotel. It's still there, because he was trained to be a porter there, for him to be able to go from being a porter to raise a family, like he did. And, I'm grateful for it. And then my grandfather on my mom's side, her dad, he actually left home when my mom was in eighth grade and never came back. They've never seen him. So I never got a chance I have fond memories of my grandmother, my maternal and paternal grandmothers, and then of my, my grandfather on my dad's side. I remember him, but my grandfather on my mom's side, I never met him, and because he left home when my mom was in eighth grade, and the family's never seen him, since then. And so that was something that my mom always kind of carried with her as a burden, as a kind of empty place in her heart. And that's why family was so important to her, to have family around, because when her father abandoned the family, it not only impacted her, but it, kind of carried it down through generations with us.
Be sure to catch live editions of Outkick the Coverage with Clay Travis weekdays at 6 a.m. Eastern, 3 a.m. Pacific.
We're talking to Big Ten Commissioner Kevin Warren. You said your dad was a PhD professor at Arizona mm-hmm. State. He had to be, I would think, just based on the timeline, to go to World War II and then end up a PhD professor. One of the first, I would imagine, black professors at Arizona State, right?
Yeah, he was. He was one of the early ones.
What was he a professor of?
In education, administrative education,
yeah.
He taught a course called the Principalship. And interesting enough, Clay, on my office desk, I keep his dissertation, and it's literally on my desk right now. And it's called The Value of Selected Public Relations Practices and Building Goodwill Between School and Community. So he ran a laboratory there that did a lot of research, the I.D. Payne Laboratory at Arizona State, but I keep his dissertation on my desk. Just as a reminder of kind of the work that he put in. And he did so much for the community. He was vice mayor in Arizona in 69. And when you think about in 69, just right after, right now, almost in the midst of civil rights movement, but to be vice mayor in Arizona, he was very instrumental in launching the Fiesta Bowl. He loved football, loved college sports, loved the kind of the bowl game, and actually was the first, I think, African-American president of the Fiesta Bowl when he became president in 1981. But he volunteered so much time from a political standpoint and educational, didn't make a lot of money. That was not his focus. But he told us, the importance of, he wanted to make sure he sacrificed to provide us an opportunity to have a great education and exposure. And he did that, with me. I mean, my parents, interestingly enough, after 49 years and 9 months of marriage, ended up getting divorced, which is the craziest thing I've
That's never unbelievable. They made it 49 years and 9 months and then got divorced?
Yeah, I got divorced. So I tell people, all the time that even Greta and I are, we'll be coming up on our 30th wedding anniversary here in about a year and a half. But I always stay focused and, stay focused on, on our marriage because, to see my parents go through that. But because of that, them having difficulties, my dad ended up, I became my dad's date for a lot of these events.
So, oh, my God.
I remember him getting me a sport coat and slacks and teaching me how to tie a tie at, 10 years old. And so all of these, events, his bank board meetings or Fiesta Bowl events, me as a young teenager, I would go with my dad, which really, helped me to kind of understand and build relationships with people and learn how to sit at a dinner and hold conversation. And so I'm grateful for that because that's been a big part of my life.
So I understand, I was reading and doing some research. When you were 10 years old, you got hit by by a car, I believe it was, right?
What happened?
What do you remember about that day? And what was the impact on your life of that event?
Yeah, I mean, it was the most impactful event of my life ever. Because I think, you know, one of the things that, that I recognize now, you know, as a, being a parent and getting older in life, you recognize that sometimes it takes people, you know, many times well into their 30s or 40s to understand how fragile life is and how special life is. And I think that's part of the reason why there's so much unhappiness in life is people don't really realize what a blessing is to be alive. And so, fortunately, I was blessed that, you know, at 10 and a half years old to understand that I was fortunate to be living. I should have died that day in June. And as you said, I was riding my bike, you know, minding my business. I was going up to the local high school to play sports with friends. And, you know, how we were raised is, you know, both of my parents worked. You know, you got up, you made your bed up immediately. You said your prayers. You took a shower. You brushed your teeth. You know, you did your chores. We all had, you know, a list of chores, but because I was home other than, you know, with my sister, I had the most of them. But, you know, we did our chores, and then you could go play in the summer. And so I was going up to play and then, you know, heard a loud, you know, tire screeching. And I was thinking, boy, that sounds a little bit closer than it should be. And then just took a quick look from my peripheral vision and could see the car, you know, hit me. That's the last thing I remember, but flew 30 feet in the air. There were a couple witnesses, and by the grace of God, landed on a plot of grass and a little small, you know, grass, you know, area. And I remember, you know, being knocked out, and then, you know, coming to and saying I could get up. I vividly remember that. And a neighbor who lived in our neighborhood, I didn't know him, but came running across the street and held me down. I remember looking at my leg, and I had a compound fracture of my right femur and some other, you know, injuries. But just, you know, that whole journey, you know, getting in that ambulance and wondering, you know, what was, you know, going to happen and just tasting blood in my mouth and throat and then going to hospital and all of that. And for anyone who's been, you know, through those kind of medical, you know, issues, you don't know until you know. But then to go into traction, to be in the hospital, and, you know, there are many nights looking over and seeing my mom sleep literally in a chair. And then my sister Marilyn, you know, sleeping there. They would rotate and take turns. But going through all of the, you know, the drama there, and then getting to the point when they told me they were going to take me out of, you know, traction and get the pins out of my leg, I was so happy. I was thinking, boy, I get able to go home. But then they said, you know, this is when your fun really begins. We got to put you in a body cast. So traction was just to reset the leg. But now we got to put you in a body cast. And I'm telling you what, Clay, that day, I remember that day vividly. And still to this day, I can't drink out of a straw because when it touches my lips, the memories it brings back, because they put me in this flat body cast, went all the way down to my toes of my right foot, up to my chest, right below my throat, and then down three quarters of my left leg and had a pole in between it. I have pictures that I keep on my desk of me in traction, but I'm still trying to find the picture of me in the body cast and then for them to take me home. And I spent months in that home by myself and just going through that issue, going to the bathroom in a bedpan, you know, drinking out of straws. You know, that's when there were three or four channels. There was no cable. There was no video game. There was no Madden. And then just trying to read and really just protect my mind and to have to work through that. But, you know, I just recognize that life is truly a gift from God. You got to take advantage of it. Every day that you have your health and you upright, you better do the best you can. And so that's why I don't get distracted on a lot of the issues that, you know, I face on a daily basis, because I'm for that. Should have been it for me. And for my life to be spared, I promised myself that day that they cut that cast off of me, I was going to do everything I possibly could to make the world a better place.
So let's go into that. How many bones did you end up breaking when you were hit by the car?
I broke one. I learned that the hardest and largest bone in your body is your femur, which is in your thigh bone, and it takes so much force to break it. So I broke my right femur. And still to this day, you know, I get a lot of deep tissue massages on a weekly basis, because still to this day, you know, it gets sore. And my right leg is a little bit shorter than my left leg. So I broke one, but it was the largest bone in my body, which is, I was fortunate, I mean, to not have that. But some, you know, internal injuries. I actually, funny you say that, I actually broke my wrist, my left wrist on it. But, you know, just like most things in life, sometimes we just focus on the really the big things. And but my left wrist was kind of so secondary to my right femur, is that was kind of like, oh yeah, you broke your wrist, but you know, put a little cast on that or wrap that up, that'll be fine. So, you know, for me to think that you know, 7 years later that I was able to walk on a court, a basketball court, and you know, at the University of Pennsylvania and play college basketball is you know, it was a gift.
So how long were you actually in the cast and in the traction? How long did you have to spend in a bed recovering?
You know, it was, I didn't go back to school until, I missed that first semester of my that school year. So the accident happened in June. I didn't go back to school until after the first year. So I was out out through the summer and the
6 months.
Fall. And then it wasn't right after that. I mean, because you know, it was my leg literally was sore for years. I mean, you know, I was on crutches after that. It was on sore, but they got a chance to, start doing a lot of water. You know, water aerobics, and I had a doctor who, and I appreciate doctors being direct because they're not there just to make people feel good, but he was really, you know, direct. I was accustomed to it because that's how my parents raised us. They didn't filter any words, and he didn't give me much of a chance to really be able to play sports at a high level. Again, I was a sports fanatic, you know, as a kid, and it changed the whole structure of my body. I went to being a very wiry, you know, thin young kid to, you know, gained a lot of weight because being in a body cast, because I was just dormant for so long. But he, you know, he did. I kept asking him, you know, what can I do to start working out? Because I wanted to, I was so active. And he said, you know, best thing to do is swim, and that you can do is swim. And so I did end up getting a legal settlement, not much. I think it was around $30,000, and approached my parents that, you know, to build a pool in our backyard, and which they didn't have the financial resources to do it at the time. And we had, I remember Tempe High School had a pool that would be open. Because this is pre health clubs and pre Lifetime Fitness and all these different things, and none of our family members had pools, and so my parents reluctantly, and I say reluctantly, allowed me to take a portion of my settlement to pay for a pool that we built in our backyard, and which was great because as a young person, I started to understand the importance of having financial resources and to make decisions, and when you make a decision that, you know, to write a check at that age and basically, you know, 10 and a half, 11 years old to build this pool, which I did. But it also taught me the importance of taking care of it. So I got the leaves out of it. I learned how to backwash a pool and put chlorine, you know, that we didn't have a spa boy that floats around. We did it all by hand. And I was really particular about when people swam that they weren't doing things in the pool that they should be in it. But I really just really started to grind out, you know, my own workouts, swimming, and a lot of exercises, and it took the weight off my body because I wasn't able to run or jog right away, and it built me back to the road to recovery. That's why I love the water so much now. I love to swim, and interestingly enough, my dad had to get odd jobs because he didn't get his professorship at Arizona State until later in life. For various reasons. So in the summer, he was always a lifeguard. And so we grew up around pools in the summer and learned how to swim. And one thing they remember about my dad, if you came to our house other than eating some really, really good, you know, Mexican food that my mom would make from scratch and learning how to dance and us play music and, you know, him telling stories, is that if you didn't know how to swim, he would demand that he taught you how to swim. So I've seen him teach so many people how to swim, and that he would be able to do it. So I grew up loving the water. I love the water now. I love water and love to swim. But it was through all that exercise that got me back to the point where I could, you know, start getting some training in on the ground. But I continued my aerobic exercises, and it nursed me back. So I'll tell you what, when I got a chance to be able to play basketball again and all the other sports, football. But then it was just such an emotional day when I was able to really lace my shoes up and be able to actually play college basketball.
How did you pass the time? You said you're at home sometimes by yourself. Your parents are both working, you know, from June until, let's say, the end of the year before you can go back to school. I mean, that image of not wanting to drink out of a straw even now because it reminds you of what that experience was like at 10 years old. I mean, that's a lot of time to just lay in bed and think and have your – I mean, I know you said you had 2 or 4 stations to watch on television maybe. But that's a wild that's a wild experience, right? I mean, it's a profound experience for anybody, but especially for a young kid.
Yeah, it was a, you know, I have a fortunately, you know, my oldest brother Morrison, who's 20 years older than me, his wife Dory Warren was a nurse, and so she would come by and check on me. She cared for me. I owe so much to her. So it's my nephew's Morrison's mom. But she would come by and care for me, and she would, Clay, she was so positive. I mean, like, that's why I really recognized the importance of, like, words. You know, both of my parents were loving people, but they weren't, like, you know, they didn't go out of their way to say, you know, positive affirmation. I guess my mom did more than my dad. My dad was just, he was old school. But Dory was so positive. She would tell me that I was going to heal, my leg would get stronger, and she'd give me massages, like, on my on my left foot and the tiptoes on my right, and you know, scratching the top part of my back, and I mean, she was just so encouraging to tell me how I was going to, you know, be able to live and be well. And I think that's one of the reasons why I'm comfortable in being a loner. Like, I love people, but I spend a lot of time, you know, really alone, because that's what I learned. I'm not much of a TV watcher. Never have been. I love live sports on TV, but I remember after the first couple of weeks, I never even turned the TV on. It was a little small black and white TV they put in my room, but I read, and I just kind of thought a lot. I mean, I cried a lot, I prayed an inordinate amount, but I really thought, and that's when I would really have, you know, dreams, and it was interesting. I'm writing a book called Build Your Own Pool, just about the journey that I went through with that, and I was talking to my sister. I asked my sister a couple months ago. I said, "Hey, what do you remember about staying in the hospital with me?" And she goes, "Kevin, I never told you, but," she said, "there were times that you would absolutely scream at the top of your lungs in the middle of the night." I was like, "When?" And she says, "You know, so much more, so much." Mom and I would go to the doctor and say, "And nurses, is everything okay?" And they told them, "No, he's having what these they call night terrors." And when you've been through a traumatic experience during the day, you can mask it and cover it. But at night, when you enter into a certain level of REM sleep, you know, you have what they call these night terrors. And that's what I was going through. She goes, "That's what I remember." So I started to research it and understand it. So I just remember just praying a lot. I remember reading a lot. That's when I really fell in love with reading. And the biggest thing, I remember, you know, dreaming a lot. But, Clay, these were some long days, and especially in the summer in Arizona, it gets light early and it stays light late. I could hear the kids playing outdoors. And I remember one day vividly when I was probably at my lowest moment, you know, was in the dead of summer. You know, kids were playing. I would ask my, you know, parents when they leave in the morning to at least open the shades as I start feeling a little bit better. I love the, you know, the sunlight looking outside. And I remember I was at one of my lowest moments, like, am I going to make it through this? And I remember seeing a bird, you know, just kind of land almost like at the tree right outside my window and was staring at me. And it was almost like God was speaking to me. It was almost like nature saying, and that was my lowest moment. Every day from then, I just kind of got a little bit closer, you know, closer. And then I remember I would go get these checkups. They'd have to borrow our neighbor station wagon. They would put me in the back of the station wagon, no seat belt, and drive from Tempe to Phoenix. I'd be sliding around in this cast. And then they would carry me out. 2 people would grab my legs and carry me in there. But I remember when I went in, the day that I went in to get that cast off, and you're talking about ecstatic. So I don't have many regrets, but 2 regrets I have. When they cut it off, they asked me if I wanted to keep it. And I said, absolutely not. I wish I would have kept it. And then the other thing, I saved my bike from my accident for probably 35 years. I had it in my parents' shed in the backyard right by the pool I built. And when my parents were divorced, as I said, and when my dad died, they hired a company to come over and clean up everything and, you know, have an estate sale. And they threw my bike away because I was living in Detroit and working at the Lions at the time. And they threw, you know, my bike away. And I would have loved to have just, you know, had that. But I thought a lot and I prayed a lot. I made my mind up. I would come up with what I call these dream lists of things that I was going to accomplish, you know. My mom being around a librarian, I love globes. Then I would dream of where I wanted to travel to, you know, in the world, what I was going to really do. And I knew then I wanted to become a doctor to help people or a lawyer. And so it was a great time. But what it did, it gave me really just kind of great level of mental toughness. And I just made my mind up if I could get out of this bed and walk again, then I would never complain about anything. I would embrace every workout. I would embrace every day. I would help as many people as I possibly could. I would count my blessings, and I would spend the rest of the days on the earth trying to make the world a better place.
Fox Sports Radio has the best sports talk lineup in the nation. Catch all of our shows at foxsportsradio.com. And within the iHeartRadio app, search FSR to listen live.
We're talking to Big Ten Commissioner Kevin Warren. I'm Clay Travis. This is the Wins and Losses podcast. What did you read? What was when you're 10 years old and you're locked in that bed? Like, what was I grew up, I loved the Hardy Boys, right? Like, I would read every little mystery. Like, what were you reading at that point in time?
You know, a lot of the stuff that I read, because my mother was a librarian, is, you know, did magazines. I just read whatever I got my hands on, and she would, you know, she'd quite naturally give me books. My parents were big into encyclopedias, and I remember a lot of the reading that I did. I know this sounds crazy, and I'm embarrassed to even say it from a nerdy standpoint, is my dad would always challenge us, like, just go grab an encyclopedia and just, you know, open it up and just to read. I remember when the Encyclopedia Britannica, I tell my kids this, they look at me like, what are you talking about? You know, a salesperson would come by the house, and my dad, we always had those in my parents' family room growing up.
That was a big deal them. for people who don't know. Like, if you, I remember my parents buying the encyclopedia because that was the internet before you had the internet, right? Like, any question you had, mom and dad would say, "Hey, go look." I remember we had the World Book Encyclopedia in the house. They weren't cheap, right? But if your parents valued learning, that you had an encyclopedia set, that was a big deal. And you go look it up because, you know, there wasn't any. Mom and dad didn't know the answer to everything, but they're like, "That's why we got the encyclopedia. Go look it up. Go read it.
Go look it up." So my parents and my mom would leave some of those by my bed in the morning, and I really ended up reading most of, and I just love to learn, and, you know, but whatever, you know, okay, I got R through S today, and you just flip through and you start reading about, you know, famous people in the world. You read about, you know, different countries, and, you know, you learn. I learned so much, and that just really gave me my insatiable desire just to kind of to learn and know. And I'm constantly, if I hear one thing, you know, I just don't take the answer. I'll go look and you know, learn about, like I said, I love reading biographical material about people, because one thing I found out, Clay, whoever it is, you know, most people, especially who have kind of made it to the top of the proverbial mountain, that, you know, people recognize that it gets windy. I mean, you know, you can stand on the ground and wind can blow and it won't knock you over, but the higher you go up a mountain is that the wind blows. I mean, you know, it's hard to stand up. So I recognize that. And so I love reading the struggle and the journey about people. And so regardless of what it is, I don't care if it's an athlete, an entertainer, someone like you, to do what you do, we all have those times in our life when we were worried about how we were going to get to the next day. And I love reading about people's kind of struggle and then for them to be able to make through it. So that's why I love the encyclopedia.
We're talking to Kevin Warren, Big Ten Commissioner. So I want to jump ahead because you went to law school, and I'm fascinated by people who what their experience in law school was.
Right. Well, you're a lawyer.
Yeah. I went to Vanderbilt for law school, ended up doing what I do now. What was your experience like at Notre Dame? How did you find your first year of law school? How did you like law school in general during that process?
That's a great question. I'll tell you, mine was a little different than most people because, one, I had gone to MBA school first.
Yep.
I was a little bit older than some of my classmates. And I went to Notre Dame. I got admitted to the MBA JD program at Arizona State, but I got a call from my sister, the one who cared for me. You know, life is as I call it, spiritual synchronicity. And she was the one who cared for me in the hospital when I had my accident. She was really struggling and had two little kids. They were living in South Bend, Indiana. And so she asked me to come care for her. And so I finished my MBA at Arizona State, went to Notre Dame. So when I went to Notre Dame, I went there with a purpose. You know, I went there to one, my number one goal was to get my sister back to being healthy and care for her two kids. And so I was up incredibly early in the morning.
How old were the kids?
They were young. They were like 4 and 6.
And you're at this point, like how old are you at this point?
Well, I'm 23 years old.
And you got no kids yourself, not married, like you're otherwise.
Single guy. Yeah, single guy and lived in her basement and cared for the kids. Ironically, both of them are lawyers now.
Oh,
my
wow.
Nephew,
yeah.
John Anthony is a lawyer at Greenberg Traurig in Phoenix, and my niece, Brittany, is a lawyer in D.C. She does family law, so it was interesting. So I cared for them. My brother-in-law was, as I said, John Shoemate. He was on Digger Phelps' staff at the time, so he was out recruiting. So I was doing, you know, doing what you're supposed to do. So by the time I went to class in the morning, I'd already had a full day. I got my run in and my push-ups and sit-ups, got the kids, you know, ready, you know, for school, did my homework reading, helped my sister. So when I went to school, I was there on a mission, and I was not fooling around. I was not, you know, focused on who could drink the most beer. And I loved Notre Dame. It was a great law school. It was smaller. We had a smaller class. And so I actually loved law school because back to my days of reading, like I love to read, I love to learn. It was really hard. I mean, I did well in school, but I was one of those people that had to spend a lot of time that did not come, you know, naturally. And so I had to really, really read and brief my cases and took, you know, great notes and had my nephew Morrison, you know, teases me. He said, Kevin, you were, you know, your notes were legendary. But if he actually was in the law school class right behind me, he came to law school, so he took all the classes I took and you know used my.
He got the benefit of all your hard work. Yeah,
I enjoyed law school because of the learning. It was really hard, you know, for me, but I enjoyed it, and because I tell my kids, even if you don't plan on practicing, go to law school because you get a chance to learn how all this in the world fits together. There's nothing you can do without a lawyer. You can't buy a house, you can't buy a car, you can't go to college, all the legal documents. So I enjoyed it, and the thing that also helped me enjoy it is for my nephew to encourage him, because he didn't know what he wanted to do, to encourage him to come to law school and then to help facilitate him coming to Notre Dame Law School, and then now to see how well he's doing in his legal career. You know, it was great. But I enjoyed it. I was one of those nerds that, you know, loved to read and loved to write and learn. We had phenomenal, you know, professors, and some of our textbooks were written by them. But, like, even our criminal law, criminal procedure professor was Robert Blakely, who was, you know, one of the founders and originators of, who wrote the RICO laws. And he would tell us stories. You know, that were amazing. Charles Rice, you know, Professor Rice, who was our torts teacher, and Professor Murphy, you know, who wrote the contracts book. So to be at Notre Dame, and then our dean was iconic, Dean David Link. And I remember our night before law school, I go to Notre Dame. I finished my MBA, first of all, like 3 or 4 days before class starts. I get across country, get to South Bend, and get, you know, squared away in the basement of my sister's and brother-in-law's home. And we go to a picnic at Dean Ling's house, and then he takes us over to the law school that same weekend, and we watch To Kill a Mockingbird.
Oh, yeah.
And it's, yeah, to watch that movie with Atticus Finch, and to sit there, and I remember at the end of the movie, we were in the courtroom at Notre Dame, and he looked at us, and he said, you're here. You came to Notre Dame, and our goal for you and for all of us is to build a different kind of lawyer. We don't want you to be a lawyer, just any lawyer. We want you to be different. And I remember I'll never forget. He said, we're here to basically, if we were a car factory, we would be producing Maseratis. So we want to be really unique. When you see them, you say, okay, that's a Notre Dame lawyer. And that movie, every time I watch To Kill a Mockingbird, it brings back memories, and I'm so grateful for Notre Dame. I love Notre Dame. I love the education that I received there from a law school standpoint, and it was a blessing to be able to get a law degree from Notre Dame.
How'd you end up working with Mike Slive when you graduated?
So go to Notre Dame. Quite naturally, Arizona State has a strong Notre Dame footprint. So I interview, I end up getting a job at O'Connor Kavanaugh, which ended up getting morphing into Greenberg Traurig, but at O'Connor Kavanaugh. So I worked there my first summer. Second summer, I go back to Phoenix and work at a firm called Snell and Wilmer. So I had
still both big law, for people out there who are not familiar, those are big law firms, corporate law firms that a lot of top law kids or graduates would go into. So you have those options that are out there.
I got those options. I had options in New York because I interviewed everywhere, you know, in New York and L.A. I had some opportunities to go to L.A. and then, but I made up my mind. I was going back home to be a lawyer in Phoenix, and especially with my, you know, family's name. Like I said, not a lot of financial resources, but a lot of access. I was going to build a great practice there. And then literally on the way back to Notre Dame for my last semester, and I was always, you know, focused on having financial resources. And my parents, you know, from my accident on, I never got a dollar from my parents. I mean, scholarships paid for college, and you know, I was self-sufficient, you know, financially. So I would always work during that month off that we would get over the Christmas holidays. And so I worked that month off. I was going back to Notre Dame, had the last semester to do before I graduated, and had actually accepted a job to go work at O'Connor Kavanaugh. So I was going back, finishing my classes and graduate and come back home and take the bar, study for the bar. And I spoke with an individual by the name of Bill Jones, who is just an incredible lawyer in Phoenix. His firm, ironically, is called Jones, Skelton, and Hockley, and his partner was Ed Hockley. And so I talked to Bill Jones. He goes, Kevin, I know you love sports. He goes, I got a dear friend who's a lawyer in Chicago named Mike Slive, and he and I worked together on, you know, one of the NCAA investigations. You should call him and go see him, and I know you're coming back to Phoenix to work, but he'd be a good person just to know. He's a really good guy in sports. So great. So I called Mike. I had a little small Toyota Corolla with about over 100,000 miles on it, and Mike said, hey, I'm in the middle of an investigation, but I can meet you for breakfast in downtown Chicago on Saturday at like 7 o'clock. So I remember getting in my – because I didn't want to be late. I remember getting in my car because I didn't know if, you know, the car would totally make it there, like 4 in the morning, and driving from South Bend to Chicago. I want to be like an hour and a half early because I don't want to miss this meeting. There's no cell phones and all that stuff. You had to be there. So I drove from South Bend to Chicago, met him downtown, and had a early breakfast with him because he was an early riser, and just really connected. I felt like this guy's special and really connected with him. Ironically, the place we met was right near the Palmer House, which is where the Big Ten was founded, but met with him. And no sooner than I made it back to South Bend, he had left a voicemail on my answering machine saying, you know, he'd love to offer me a job. And so I called my firm saying I got a chance to work in sports, and they said, Kevin, no problem. We'll just defer your acceptance here. So I called Mike back, accepted the job, and then he calls me a month later and go, oops, we got a little change. We're moving our firm from Chicago to Overland Park, Kansas, because that's where the NCAA was headquartered. Will that affect your decision? I said, no. And so we moved there. So instead of me going to Chicago, I go to Overland Park, Kansas, and thank God that happened because that's how I met my wife, you know, Greta. So that's how I met Mike Slive, worked with him, and then he left. Actually, that's why it gets interesting to go to the Great Midwest Conference at the time. You know, he launched it and offered me to go with him, which I didn't. And that's when he told me, you eventually will be in college sports, you know, one day due to your heart, your passion for the love of the student athletes, and stayed in touch with him. Still to this day, I keep in contact with his wife Liz and his daughter Anna. And went to Mike's funeral. And one of the most emotional days is that Liz and Anna actually gave me one of the kind of the boxes that he had on his desk that he got as an award. that I keep on my desk at the Big Ten office. And they gave me one cigar from him. He loves cigars. And a note from them that I keep it right behind me, you know, always. So I deeply, deeply love Mike Slive. I'm so grateful to him and for him, because as a young black student coming out of law school, he took me everywhere with him. He took me to committee on infractions hearings. He took me on road trips to watch him, you know, interview witnesses. And so for someone to do that, you know, for me and with me, I will always carry his legacy forward.
How did you meet your wife?
Yeah, so we go to Mike moves the firm. I go to the firm, and I end up meeting her at church, which is amazing how all these things come full circle. So there was a church called St. James United Methodist Church, and the pastor was Emmanuel Cleaver, who's now a politician in Washington, D.C., Emmanuel Cleaver, who has one of the NIL bills that he's put together with Anthony Gonzalez. So we were both visiting the weekend, met, and I knew right away. I knew met her then, and I had to go out on the road with Mike to do an interview, but came back, and we had dinner together. And I called my mom that night. I said, I went from someone, you know, never talked like that, to say, Mom, I had dinner with someone tonight that I'm going to marry her. My mom was like, what? I'm like, yeah, I mean, really, this is the right person. So we met in March and had a date in March and got engaged in October, ironically, at the Grotto at Notre Dame. We were back on campus and then got married the following June of 92. And so I'm just grateful. Greta is, you know, smart. She's a brilliant woman. She is tough as nails and steady and sturdy. And has done an incredible job, one, with you know, just shepherding my career and being there, but then also raising our kids. And just that she's as solid as they come. And I owe really my career to her. I'm appreciative of her each and every day. And it's been a blessing for her to be my wife, and me to be her husband, and for her to be the parents of our kids. So she's a great woman. I look forward to the day that you can meet her.
We're talking to Big Ten Commissioner Kevin Warren. This is Wins and Losses. I'm Clay Travis. All right, so you leave the Mike Slive relationship, and what do you do then?
Mike leaves, actually, to take the job at Great Midwest,
yep.
Which now morphs into Conference USA. I don't go with him. I stay with Glazier.
Was that a tough decision?
Stay with Glazier. Yeah, so he stays. I keep doing the work that they're doing, the investigations. And then all of a sudden, one of my professors from Notre Dame, Patricia O'Hara, calls me and says, hey, I just got promoted to Vice President of Student Affairs. Will you come back? I said, sure. So I went back to Notre Dame, taught a sports law class in the law school, worked in administration, an assistant vice president of student affairs for a year. And then and while I was there, ended up, someone introduced me to Chris Zorich, who was a rookie on the Bears at the time. You know, he had lost his mom and just wanted some help. And so after I left Notre Dame to go back to Kansas City to get married to Greta, I started my own, you know, sports practice and started representing, you know, Chris. And then ended up working with Lake Dawson and Will Shields and even your great partner, Jason Whitlock. And so built a business in representation business in Kansas City, and then just like Bill Jones did with Mike Slive, I had a friend who connected me with Dick Vermeil, who had just got hired at the Rams in '97, and someone said, you know, you guys would really like each other. It's the same way that Bill Jones said with Mike Slive. So you'd really like Coach Vermeil and I. Same type deal. Flew to St. Louis. And sat down with Coach Vermeil, almost very similar to the way the Mike Slive meeting went. And then all of a sudden, Coach Vermeil's like, I'd love to have you come work with me. And it was just something about him, just like with Mike Slive, that I knew this is a person that I would love to follow.
When you're teaching at Notre Dame, did you like teaching sports law at Notre Dame? What was that experience like? Because you're a young guy teaching. And by the way, did you ever meet Amy Coney Barrett, who now is on the Supreme Court and is probably the most famous Notre Dame law grad, I would imagine, right now in the country?
She was asked, so I was a 90 grad. I think she's like quite naturally, I know her because I've stayed in contact with Notre Dame. I go back on campus every so often and speak to law schools. I don't know why I thought she's like a 98 grad. She was after me there, and yeah, she is famous. And
well, everybody on campus evidently loved her as a professor too, right? Like
yeah,
the students.
Yeah, they loved her. Yeah, people do love her. I mean, they really did love her. So I just wish her well to be on the Supreme Court. You're talking about amazing
achievement,
you know, experience. So I'm looking forward to having a chance to hopefully sit down and talk with her one day. But she's in the Notre Dame family. But yeah, I enjoy teaching. I mean, teaching is in my blood. Like I said, my mom being an educator, my dad being an educator, I enjoyed. I was young, and a lot of the students I was teaching that some of them quite actually were older than me. So I enjoyed it, and I think that's something. Later in my life and my career that I'll go back to, be an adjunct, professor at some point in time in a couple years from now, because I really enjoyed back to me loving to, to read and to write and communicate. And hopefully I'll have some knowledge to share with some students here at some point in time, in the future. But I enjoyed it. I really enjoyed that.
We're talking to Big Ten Commissioner Kevin Warren. So you work at the Rams. You find a guy named Kurt Warner who has a little bit of success. Mm-hmm. I'm a Titans fan, so yeah. So you end up beating the Titans in that very memorable Super Bowl, and you start to work inside of an NFL franchise. What's that like, and what's Dick Vermeil like?
Yeah, it was, it was interesting. I mean, we were, we were the losingest franchise in the 90s up until 97. I think we were tied with the Cincinnati Bengals. So we go in there. I mean, we go 5-11 our first year, and then we go 4-12. So people are looking at me like, okay, you had a really good business, and you win 9 games in 2 years. We won 9 games in 2 years, and we all had 3-year contracts. So that's not good going in the third year of the contract with 9 wins in 2 years. And I think ownership had clearly made a plan to terminate Coach Vermeil at the end of the end of that season. And I remember he in training camp, he showed a clip from this movie Amistad, and it was like basically, if not now, when? I mean, this is our year. All of us are going to be gone, and things fell into place. And like I said, Kurt was there.
Well, Trent Green
hurt his knee.
That's right. Yep. That's a huge story, there. Right? Because yep. Trent Green, the yep. expectation was that he was going to be great, and Dick Vermeil cried, I think, after, if I remember correctly, in a press conference after Trent hurt his knee.
Yep. Yeah, you're right. Great memory. That's when he said, we will play good football. Trent, we had signed him, I believe, from Washington, and because he had worked with Mike March, who was our offensive coordinator, who had worked at the Rams previously, who became head coach. And I think third preseason game against San Diego, Rodney Harrison stumbled into Trent's knee towards ACL. I remember I went down to the locker room and was there with Trent in the locker room, when he was hurt. Kurt comes in and we end up not signing. So many people were leaning. And that's what I really learned. You got to just stick with what's in your spirit and heart, do the right thing. And Coach knew Kurt Warner was a great player. And I remember going to practices. I've seen Kurt have a full practice and not one ball hit the ground.
Yeah.
Zero. I mean, and so that was my standard of like, that's like a legitimate quarterback right there. It was none of this throwing it over the head in the dirt. I mean, he was so focused. And to see him elevate, and he has the same initials and I. So when he started his crazy rise to stardom, these people would try to go through our voicemail at the Rams Park to leave a message for him, and they would end up hitting KW, backing into it, especially WA. So I'd get more messages from fans.
Congratulating that's
him.
Funny.
But Kurt was such a steady. I've stayed in close contact with him. So Dick was. Coach Vermeil was special. I stay in close contact with him. His birthday was a couple months ago, and I talk with he and his wife, Carol, regularly. I stay in touch with him. As soon as we get through this pandemic, I'll go and have dinner with him. We share the same love of wine, and he's a father to me. I mean, I consult with him all the time. So he was spectacular. I learned so many lessons from him. And then, so we just went for it. We had Kurt. We drafted Torrey Holt. We had drafted Orlando Pace 2 years earlier, then Grant Wistrom, and then we traded for Marshall Faulk, and we had great coaches. I mean, that's what I learned about having good people around you. So many lessons from Coach Vermeil. I think we had 8 former NFL head coaches on our staff, and they built it, and we played with no fear, and And I'm convinced if Coach Vermeil doesn't retire at the end of the year, I probably have, instead of one Super Bowl ring and one Super Bowl trophy, I'd probably have three or four, because we had great players and a great system and a great staff, and that was really fun. That was a really fun year. And although I never used the word fair or fun, but that's one of the times I will say that was a fun year.
So you go back, you then go to the Lions, and then you go to Greenberg mm-hmm. Traurig, big international law yeah. firm, and you start working, if I'm not mistaken, for the Wilf family in their attempt to buy the Minnesota Vikings, and that puts you back into the scope of the NFL. What was that relationship yeah. like, and how did it grow to the point, as initially your lawyer, to then going in-house and basically moving to Minnesota and spending 15 years of your life there?
Yeah, so like you said, we leave the Rams. We had a great run, had a great chance to go to the Lions. You know, we didn't have much success in the 2 years there. I go back to Greenberg Traurig, and back to O'Connor Kavanaugh saying they would defer my acceptance. Well, they deferred it for 13 years. I called them
13,
up.
Yeah, 13 and, years after had, you said, yeah.
I had the job in 90, and I said, remember you guys said you would defer my acceptance? They said, yeah, because the same people were there, Jeff Verbin. Was there, and I said, well, I always keep my word. So 13 years later, I'm ready to accept that offer. He said, it's still here. So that's how I ended up at Greenberg Traurig. So I go back there, and crazy as it would be, I ended up, so I go back to Greenberg and pretty much, you know, July of that year of 2003. And I'm working there. And then the next, probably March or April of 2004, I get a call one day from Denny Green and the late, great coach. And he says, hey, you know, out here the Vikings are for sale. I'd love to try to put together a group. And I'm going to be in town. And will you come to a kind of a reception? There's going to be about 40 or 50 people to get together in Phoenix. And I'd love for you to come and attend. I said, great. So I show up there. I went and saw the Sacramento Kings play the Phoenix Suns, and it was, you know, that was really early, though, because I saw, I think, LeBron's first probably preseason game that same year. But I go to this deal at the Phoenician in Phoenix, and what Coach Green failed to tell me is that he was going to ask me to make the presentation to the group about
yeah.
acquiring an NFL club. So I go there with my notebook and my pen ready to take some notes, and he says, yeah, you know, I'm glad you all came. Now, this meeting starting at about 11 o'clock now, because it was after the games. Glad you all came. We wanted to get people together, explore about buying the Vikings. And invited Kevin Warren, who has 6 years in the NFL, to be here and kind of walk us through the process. Thanks, Coach. So I got up, and I remember telling my wife, you know, Greta, because we went to the game together. She went home. We didn't live far from the Phoenician. I said, look, if I'm not here, I know Coach Green. I don't know these other people. But if I'm not here by like 2 in the morning, come look for me. So I ended up getting home probably about 3, because we were there meeting for about 4 hours. And got a sound asleep. And I said to her, why didn't you come get me? She said, I know you'd be fine. But so the meeting went well, morphed in there. One of the people who ironically was the meeting, in the meeting was Reggie Fowler, and so I ended up meeting, you know, Reggie there. I didn't know Reggie, but ended up meeting there, and that's how it kind of started. But you know, when we started talking with Reggie, he needed partners, and so I had a dear friend, Jim Stapleton, who's still a dear friend. He went to college in Michigan with a guy by the name of Ray Owens, who had done some real estate work with Alan Landis. And that's why I say, Clay, when you look back over my life, and all the different things that had to fall into place, you know, to happen. So Jim had a friend at Michigan who did some work with Alan Landis in real estate named Ray Owens, that said, hey, there may be a family in New York who also is interested in being an owner in the NFL. And he said, it's the Landis family, the Mandelbaum family, and the Wolf family. I said, great. And, you know, all you had to do is tell me something one time. And I was on a plane within probably 48 hours going back to see the Wilf family, Mandelbaum family, Landis family, to present in front of them and telling them about the deal. And I remember after about a two-hour presentation to them, barely taking a breath or a drink of water, they convened the back conference room and they came out and said, yeah, we're in as limited partners. And then as the deals start going back and forth. So I was flying red eye flights from Phoenix to New York to meet with them and start working on the deal. And then when Reggie didn't have the financial wherewithal to be the general partner, I remember like it was yesterday, standing in my closet in Phoenix. It was Ziggy's birthday that I had to call him and say, you know, hey, we need an opportunity. We're going to need an opportunity to become general partner. And so that's when we did it, and we really had to put the pedal to the metal and get the deal done, and we did get it closed. And when it closed, I remember we had the closing at Skadden Arps in New York. You know, yeah, I mean, you've been in these big deals, and this was one of the ones where every conference room was taken. I mean, we must have signed, you know, 100 pieces, 100 documents. And so we finished the closing, went a couple hours, and after we finished, Will sat down and said, okay, what happens now? Like, is you know, Red McCombs and his group going to meet us in Minnesota and the transition? I was like, Ziggy, when that wire hit Mr. McCombs' account today, you won't be hearing much from him. They're just to confirm that he gets, you know, Super Bowl tickets every year going forward. No, there's not going to be anyone there. He goes, what do you mean? I said, no. He goes, well, what happens? I said, you guys got to go to Minnesota and meet with the staff and introduce yourselves and tell them what's going to happen. And he's like, can you go with us? Can you meet us there? And so that's what happened. So we didn't go back to Phoenix. I went straight to Minnesota and met there. I remember actually meeting Mike Stalick, is his name, from U.S. Bank, meeting him downtown at a hotel to sign the signature cards for the bank accounts, you know, just to like literally open up the accounts. And we had to form all new LLCs and we started from scratch, you know, with the Metrodome and Winter Park facility. And then to be able to look back, I'm so proud of my work there 15 years later to build the best stadium in all of pro football in U.S. Bank Stadium and the best practice facility in Twin Cities Orthopedics Performance Center, and to host the Super Bowl in a cold weather city, to build a world-class, you know, franchise. And I know eventually they'll get their trophy, you know, also. But to be able to do that, put in the work in Minnesota to raise our kids here, for our kids to get incredible educations here, and just for me to recognize a dream, and I say it every time I get a chance, for a group like the Wolf family and the Landis family and Mandelbaum family, but primarily the Wolf family, Mark, Lenny, Ziggy, and John, to afford a black man like me in their 40s to turn the keys over to an NFL franchise from a business standpoint, to say, you know, just go, we trust you, to be able to do that is I will forever, ever be grateful to them, and just owe them so much of a debt of gratitude, and just appreciated the opportunity that it afforded me to be able to do.
We're talking to Kevin Warren, Big Ten Commissioner. So you're there, you have a tremendous success with the Vikings, and then you get the opportunity to go to the Big Ten. You've been there for a year. I want to ask this question before I ask about the Big Ten. And are you okay time-wise? I know we're rolling here and it's Christmas Eve,
I have a hockey call in about 15 minutes with the Red Berenson. So, yeah, I'm good for another 15 minutes.
Yeah, perfect. All right, first question. A lot of people say MBA or JD. A lot of people out there listening right now. Which do you think is more valuable? How have they intertwined together? Because obviously you are doing a lot on both sides, both the business and the legal. How important was it for you to have both? What would you say to people out there considering the decision of an MBA or a JD?
My recommendation, and I get that asked a lot, I tell them both.
Yeah.
I could not have done my job at the Vikings with either or. Definitely if I didn't have either one of them, no way. But either or, and I don't think I could do this job at the Big Ten with, you know, if I just had an MBA or just a law degree. Just these jobs now are so complex, and it ranges from business to legal to financial, you know, to everything. And I tell people, if you're going to get one, you might as well get the other.
It's a fascinating idea, because I wish I had more business learning in my background. I never did it. I've had to kind of learn it running my own business from the seat of my pants. Yeah, but, you know.
You've done well, but I agree with it. I mean, I just look at the things on my desk right now, sitting on my desk right now. It ranges from, you know, television, you know, issues, to financial issues, the spreadsheets, you know, to accounting, to finance, to sales, to marketing, to legal, to litigation, to corporate, to real estate. I mean, all of these different things. And so there's no way. And the reason why I did it, you know, my parents, you know, I went to MBA school first, and I was going to be done. I was ready to go work. It's the early 90s. I was ready to go. And my, I remember my both mom and dad told me, they said, you never want to be in a meeting down the road, Kevin, when you have to rely on an expert, you know, in either business or law. You want to make sure you understand it. You got to have experts in there, but you need to make sure you understand the language. And I said, okay, you're right. And that's it. I'm going.
We're talking to Big Ten Commissioner Kevin Warren. All right, so let's get to the Big Ten. You take over. Was it a tough decision to leave Minnesota and take the Big Ten job, or was it an easy decision?
It was easy. It was it was time. You know, spending 15 years here. Every single goal, I'm a goal writer, goal setter. You know, every single goal I had written down when I went to the has come to fruition at the Vikings. It was to, you know, build a new practice facility and build a new stadium, host the Super Bowl, build a world-class organization, and then win a Super Bowl. We won 4 out of 5. I mean, we accomplished 4 out of 5. It was time. It was time for me. I had done everything that I could do from a career standpoint there. And I think the biggest thing, back to Mike's Live, I mean, my love and passion for young people, for student athletes is high. And I lived it. I was a student athlete. I know what college athletics did to my life, you know, what it did in my life, and the chance it gave for me. I mean, to come from a family with no money, no resources, but to be able to go, I even know the desire, Clay, for me to become a student athlete, what it did. That's why I built my own pool, because I had a goal. My dad did it. My brother did it. Others did it from my neighborhood who went and played college sports. So I had a goal to play D1 athletics. So that was the reason why I built a pool to recover. Never knew I could do it. So I knew the importance of it. So any time that you have a chance, I said, to go, to be able to positively influence. We have 10,000 student-athletes almost in the Big Ten. So to positively influence 10,000 student-athletes across 14 different schools, across 11 states, to be able to do it, then that's really the whole, you know, that was the whole essence of me. So it was a very easy decision.
So you're there for a year, and then mm-hmm. basically less than a year in, suddenly this crazy pandemic hits. I think you took over in September of 19, if I'm not mistaken. And then in March.
I started in September, yeah. And so I went there in September as commissioner-elect. Delaney spent the last 3 months with me. I actually took over January 2nd, so it was like 70 days when the pandemic hit.
Yeah,
for me actually being a commissioner. Yeah, you're right.
So one of the things that's interesting to me is, what's the job of a commissioner in the broad sense? Is it your job to influence the presidents and chancellors, or to execute their vision, or is it a balancing act between the two? Because the reason why I ask is, you took a lot of bullets when the Big Ten starts to make its decisions, much like Roger Goodell often trots out in front of the you know, the media, and they just use him for target practice. He's trying to implement, it seems to me, very often, the vision of whatever the owners have. What exactly is that relationship like for the Big Ten, the presidents and chancellors, and how do you see your role? Is it advocate, where you're like a lawyer, you know, for people out there listening, like you advocate for your client, or are you trying to steer the ship? What is the role? What's the right role for a commissioner?
Yeah, I think it's a combination of it. I mean, because, like you said, you have a delicate balance of 10,000 student athletes, you know, and, you know, 300 and 50, you know, what, head coaches. You have your athletic administrators, you have your senior women administrators, you have your faculty athletic reps, you have your chancellors and presidents, you have your athletic directors, you have your families. So this is a whole amalgamation of people that come together who really do, you know, want the common goal. Everyone in the Big Ten, all those groups that I listed, have the focus of making sure their sons or daughters receive a world-class education. They have positive experience, learning experience, both in the classroom and in life. and they get a chance to compete at the highest possible level. And then if they're good enough, either they get a chance to go on and compete for a gold medal in the Olympics or to have a chance to play professional athletics. So it's a balance of all of those different, you know, factors. Then you throw on top of it the political climate, because we're in 11 different states. So we have, you know, 14 mayors of our cities where our schools are located, but 11 governors that we're dealing with, and then even all the way to from a national political landscape. So it's a balance. So I think the, you know, commissioner, is responsible for making sure that all of these different groups are, you know, heard, are listened to. And to make sure, just but from a global standpoint, that the whole purpose and the structure of the Big Ten is one, never forgotten, and two, really, you know, empowered. And so my focus of coming here was to make sure that our student athletes kept in mind, you know, first and foremost, we need to provide an environment for them to get a world-class education, that they can compete in a safe and healthy manner. But then also that the Big Ten remains the Big Ten. What are the cornerstones of why is the Big Ten in business? And that we keep those, but then to elevate, you know, the conference from a business standpoint, from a long-term standpoint. And I know, you know, there were some days that I was thinking, whoa, you know, coming in here and then having the pandemic hit 70 days after I'm in on a job that's, you know, complicated, you know, even in a normal time. But I'm almost grateful that it happened, because what it did is it helped to expedite the importance of us communicating, working in a collaborative manner, being focused, doing what's right. And so a lot of these issues that were eventually going to come out, now, I'll say this, it was interesting that they came out, you know, all in the last 10 months. But, you know, maybe it would have taken 5, 6, 7, 10 years for them to come out. They eventually would have come out. But I feel now more prepared going into 2021 to be able to deal with name, image, and likeness, and all the business issues, and, you know, dealing with our TV and network partners, because we were forced. It was almost what I call taking like a J-term class. You know, instead of doing it, you know, over a course of a year or a semester, you do it in 2 or 3 weeks. And the way you do it is you have to go to class longer, you have to study, you have to pull together, you have to be focused. And I think this year of 2020 allowed us that opportunity. So I am encouraged, I'm positive, I'm excited about finishing 2020 up, but also really looking in 2021. So a lot of the issues that business and people, especially new to each other, need to get out of the way to work through, you know, we were forced to work through them this year, and I feel like we're a strong group going forward.
Be sure to catch live editions of Outkick the Coverage with Clay Travis weekdays at 6 a.m. Eastern, 3 a.m. Pacific.
Do you wish, looking back now, you've got Ohio State in the playoff, the Big Ten bowl games are out there, there's still games to be played this year, but the regular season is over. Do you wish now that you could go back to July and August and start play in September? In retrospect, and obviously retrospect, 2020 vision is always better. Do you think that would have been the right decision? And if so, could you have convinced the presidents and chancellors to make that choice? How aggressively is it your job to try to make that case? Does that make sense?
That makes sense. That's a great question. I believe, and I still feel strongly about it, you know, today, is the fact that the thing I'm most proud of is that we followed the medical advice of our medical personnel. And that's what I'm probably most proud of. Trust me, Clay, as you said, it was not easy. It wasn't easy on us as a conference. It wasn't easy on me personally, but this has never been about me. So all these jobs, this is not about me. This is about the Big Ten. This is about our student athletes. This is about our coaches. This is about our brand. And so that's why I was okay to deal with it. One, all those nights and spent in the hospital in traction, all those nights spent in the body cast, I'm comfortable with being alone. I'm mentally tough. I'm physically tough. I'm comfortable with not being popular. I was not a popular kid when I went back to school after my accident. My nickname even became, it went from being at first making fun of me to endearing. But if you talk to my high school teammates, my nickname was Fatty. Now, you know, that's what we, you know, the kids are brutal, but that's what it was.
Because you put on weight after you were in the
Right, the body cast. Yeah, the day I got hit by a car, my body fat was, you know, probably as low as it could be for a 10-year-old kid. And then when I came out, it was as high as it could be. And so that was my nickname all the way until the time I went to college, was Fatty. And that's always been there. So I'm accustomed to you know, dealing with, you know, those kind of issues. So I wouldn't change anything. Was it rough? Yes, it was rough. But the thing that gave me solace and strength was the fact we made the right decision. Why? Because we did it for the health and safety of our student athletes. And I was concerned about myocarditis. I was concerned about making sure we did everything, you know, for the health and safety to put our student athletes number one. I don't expect for it to make sense to everyone, you know, this soon. There's still a lot of, like, kind of raw emotions. But I'm confident, whether it's a year from now, 3, 5, 7, 10, that when we turn around and look back at 2020, people will say, you know what, the Big Ten did the right thing. In a pandemic, we can't forget we were playing sports in a global pandemic. Our focus always, we took the hard road. The easy road would have been for us just to go and play and kind of cross our fingers and toes and hope that it works out. But we took the hard road of trying to put in our daily testing in to keep our student athletes healthy and safe. That is my number one priority in the story. They need to get a world-class education. They need to be healthy and safe, and they need to be able to participate at a high level. Everything else, you know, is secondary. And I'm just, you know, proud that our medical, you know, doctors and trainers really designed the program. Is it perfect? No, nothing about 2020 is perfect. If anything, this is the year of being fluid. But I'm confident that we made the right decision, because why? We put the health and safety of our student athletes at the top of our list.
Even if you're tough, it still had to be tough to be the guy taking all of the slings and arrows, right? Nobody knows who the president. Most people out there don't know who the president of insert school is, right? Unless you're a student on campus or a professor. Everybody knew Kevin Warren. Fire Kevin Warren. I don't even know if you ever just got on Twitter and typed in your name to see what people were saying about you. But even if you say you're tough, and I'm tough, you're tough, anybody who you talked about earlier, in order to make it to the top of any kind of flagpole, you got to be tough, and people are going to take shots at you. That had to be tougher than anything you've ever gone through in your career, though, right?
I agree. Yeah, I agree. And the, you know what it is, and I interesting. I try to keep things real simple, and that's why I love my wife, among other things. But she that's how she operates, and really, as I call it, kind of sound bites. And I always try to have one prayer going into every new year. I'll do it this year. So over the next week, I'll come up with like one focal. And my focal point last year for 2019 going into 2020 was to basically for me to, although my faith has always been strong, but for me to even the last part of any journey is the most difficult part. I said I wanted my faith to even go stronger. So my prayer on New Year's Eve last year was, God, even though my faith is as strong, and I don't know if it can grow stronger, but if it can, please make it happen. Now, I didn't know it was going to be what I went through last year, but as I look back, the reason why I'm okay with what happened is, all in all, aside from work, it was tough. You're right, it was tough, but my faith grew even stronger. Even when I didn't think it could, it did. And so when I asked myself, was it worth it? Absolutely, it was worth it. Because I try to always back to my accent, look at everything kind of from a spiritual landscape. And it was worth it. And it's not for the faint of heart. It's not something I can say I want to go through. But we did. You know, we survived. We actually did better than survive. We actually were able to thrive. And we have four teams and great bowls. We have the Ohio State University in the college football playoff. We've forged some strong relationship, our relationship with our network partners at Fox and ESPN, ABC, and CBS is strong. And we've all learned and grown. And I'm looking, you know, forward to continually building this relationship with our chancellor and presidents, our athletic directors, our coaches. But most of all, I'm looking forward to watching our student athletes and their families grow, and for us to continually win championships in the Big Ten and continually be the Big Ten. And so I'm just, you know, even this relationship, I'm grateful that we're able to spend the time that we have together, and I'm grateful for everything that you do. So I just have a heart of gratitude as we go into this holiday season, and I just hope, you know, everyone had Happy Hanukkah and and Merry Christmas, and really that we go into 2021 stronger together as a country.
One couple of questions here to finish up with. You were talking to Big Ten Commissioner Kevin Warren. Your son plays at Mississippi State. I think he still had a couple of years left. From your perspective, I just mentioned earlier in the conversation, I've got three kids, you've got two. Mm-hmm. How difficult was it to be the Big Ten commissioner with your team's not scheduled to be playing and your son is going to be playing at Mississippi State? You talked about medical professionals and everything else, but he's grown. How do you balance the role of a parent with a son in a different conference when you are the commissioner of the Big Ten? To me, that's one of the most challenging aspects, probably both professionally and personally for you. How did you handle that?
Yeah, Clay, you're exactly right. That was, you know, I'm one of those folks. I can handle it. You know, I'm a grown man. But, you know, the people I feel the most for, my wife Greta and my kids, because they didn't sign up for it. And so I felt primarily, you know, bad for Powers, but it allowed him to grow. And so he did what he was supposed to do. He went to Mississippi State. He had three head coaches in 3 years. He got his degree in 3.5 years. He was very focused, and he worked hard. And so he graduated about a month ago, got his degree, you know, early, and he still has 2 years of eligibility remaining. So he entered into the transfer portal. He has some opportunities now that he's evaluating, and I'm sure he'll make a decision here in the next couple of days to decide where he's going to go and play his last 2 years, and he can work on his master's. So he's done well. I'm proud of him. He's tough, as also mentally tough, and he's continually grown. And I think he realizes now, as he's said to me before, you know, he realizes why I don't use the word fair, because just life is not fair, and if you're looking for fairness, you're probably going to be frustrated. So I'm grateful for him. And our daughter Perry just got admitted to Northwestern School, that she'll be starting her master's in the fall in business communication. So as you know, Clay, with three sons, you know, anytime you can wake up in the morning and say your prayers and know that your wife is healthy and your kids are healthy, then you know, you got a chance for a great day. So I just have a heart of gratitude, and it starts with my family. And we've had a great run together, and I hope we can live together forever.
Did you talk to him about that decision? He was going to play at Mississippi State, or because I'll tell you this: if I tell my kids that I suggest something, by the time they're already don't want to do whatever Dad says, right? I mean, I think there's a lot of kids a lot of parents out there listening who know what I'm saying. My oldest are 12 and 10; they're not yet 18. Right. But once they get to be 18, like if you said, "Hey, son, I don't think it's safe enough for you to be playing football," and oh, by the way, we're not playing in the Big Ten. He just might turn to you and say, "Peace out, Dad. I'm playing," right? Like, I mean, right? I mean, did you ever have that conversation with him as a parent?
I did. We did. Greta and I had it with him. And we raised our kids similar to as Greta and I were raised. Our parents treated us like adults, you know, early on, to make decisions and make decisions, live with the consequences. So all I did is I laid out to him, here are the medical concerns that I have as a parent, you know, as a father, as a commissioner, for all of our student athletes. But I'm talking with you. But this year, you know, you're an adult, and I know you'll do what's right. And so that's why he made the, you know, decision to be able to go forward. And he understood all the ramifications. And I've just found in life is that the more you can allow people a chance to own their, you know, decisions, the better off that they can be. And so he was comfortable and playing and doing what he is, just like when he graduated and wanted to enter into the, you know, transfer portal. He has 2 years left to play. And so he'll make his decision where he goes to school. I'm just here as a, you know, I always take my commissioner hat off at home, because I'm just, you know, dad and husband, and I'll give him, you know, advice on things that he comes to me, but I won't get involved in any recruiting or anything of that nature. So wherever he decides to go, I'll support him. And be there for him like always, and just tell him, just own it, you know, own the decision and kind of live with the consequences.
What was it like to be called by the White House in the middle of all of this process? And on top of that, you don't control headlines that are written, but one headline that got a ton of attention, I'm looking at it right now from Yahoo. It said, "Can the Big Ten swing the next presidential election?" It's an interview with you from June, which sets the perception out there that your decision was political in nature as opposed to medical in nature. I don't know that you've gotten a chance to really talk about that very much, but what was that experience like interacting with the White House, with the president, and what was the experience like as this being seen as a political situation for you?
Yeah, that was demanding for me to deal with because, again, people who know me, you know, I believe so much in this country. I believe in our political process. I vote. I'm passionate about it. You know, it was hard for especially black people to have a chance to vote. So I don't take that lightly. But I am, you know, when we set up our voter registration initiative at the Big Ten, if I said it once, I've said it 100 times, it's nonpartisan. And I really mean that because I vote for candidates and I vote for different people from different political backgrounds.
You voted for Democrats and Republicans in your life as a person. Yeah,
absolutely. So I'm not just one of these people that goes in the booth and puts a blindfold on and, you know, swipes either all one side or the other. That's not, I'm very thoughtful. And so I study the candidates and go into and their background, even for local politics, I go into it. And so that part, like you said, not writing the headlines, and I think that's where a lot of this started, from just the kind of that I was trying to swing an election is just the opposite. But, you know, anytime I always, you know, I grew up to the day that my parents died, and still my in-laws are both living in their mid-80s, Hayward and Hattie Spears. They're my parents, Greta's parents, but they're like parents to me. Still to this day, they'll address them as yes, ma'am, and yes, sir. To this day, to the day my parents died, it was yes, ma'am, and yes, sir. That's how I was raised. And so I respect the office of the president. I mean, that's the president of the United States of America. And regardless of what people, the political views they have, right, wrong, or indifferent, I respect that office, and I respect the person in the office. And so when the White House called, you know, I took it as I take everything as face value that they were willing to help. The President Trump was willing to help and offer from a medical standpoint, and I think many people. I got many calls from people, local, nationally, and around the world who offered to help. So I say that from a respect standpoint, and I'm grateful that we were able to work through, you know, our issues and then put a program in place that we thought is in the best interest of our student athletes. But I'll say this, Clay, as you said, 2020 will be a year that I will probably be telling, my grandkids about that once we have them for many years in the future.
Last question for you, and it's probably a tough one, but I appreciate all your time, and I know how busy you are, Big Ten Commissioner Kevin Warren. Mm-hmm. There's a perception out there that the Big Ten has been bending over backwards for Ohio State, changing the rules to allow them into the Big Ten title game, the medical recommendations as it pertains to positive tests and quarantining being adjusted, I think, after the first of the year. How would you respond to critics out there who say that the Big Ten is bending over backwards for Ohio State compared to other schools?
Yeah, I mean, I think the response is you know, my focus is to make sure I do everything I can to keep the Big Ten Conference, all of our 14 schools, to have equality, to fairness, and to protect the conference. So, you know, when we make changes on rules or whatever, we're not singling out, you know, a school in a good way or in a bad way. Is that we're doing what we feel is in the best interest of the conference, and I've said it. You know, this year is one thing I've learned is alignment is critical. And then secondly, you got to remain nimble and fluid. We have to. I mean, things change. We get more information, you know, every single day. This has been a complicated, you know, situation. And so when I sit here, we feel that what we feel is in the best interest of all of our schools and all of our student athletes. And, you know, we have to be mindful. It's just like with the fact of making the adjustment from 21 days to 17 days is we follow a lot of the CDC requirements. So this is not, you know, me or us sitting here and saying, okay, what can we do to tilt this? It's just the opposite. We have to do what's best to afford our student athletes a chance to play. This will be the last year that a lot of our student athletes can have a chance to play. And if there's something And again, it goes back. If it fits into the health and safety and they're still healthy and safe, then we have to explore what we can do and to remain fluid and remain nimble, but also just to keep our integrity as a conference. And that's what we'll continue to do.
Kevin Warren, I appreciate the time. Look forward to chatting again sometime down the line. I think people will enjoy your story, and I hope you and your family have a good Christmas.
Me too. Clay, thank you for everything. Appreciate what you stand, how you stand tall, and I just appreciate it. I love your work, and just thank you for who you are and what you do, and have a very Merry Christmas, Happy New Year. Stay healthy and safe, and I just continually pray God's blessings over you and your family. So thank you for your time, and I'm here. Have a great day.
Appreciate it. That's Commissioner Kevin Warren. Okay. I'm Clay Travis. This is Wins and Losses. Appreciate all of you hanging out with us. Have a great New Year and a great Christmas and holidays for everybody out there as well.